Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here to tell you guys about all of the work that I've been doing. So I'm going to use my Canadian laser pointer because I'm from Ottawa, so it's nice to be able to use a hockey stick. So these are really exciting times. LIGO's detected gravitational waves, and pulsar timing arrays have not yet. And while I've done a lot of really interesting research and have played important leadership roles in all of these papers, so measuring the evolution of supermassive black hole binaries with pulsar timing arrays, looking at when the pulsar term is important for backgrounds, I've done work on fast radio bursts, on final parsec physics with gravitational wave backgrounds, and even on primordial backgrounds, possibly from inflation or maybe from cosmic strings. I can't talk about any of these things today because that would just take way too much time. So instead, I'm going to focus on two things. And I'm going to focus on characterizing anisotropy in the gravitational wave background and then moving to the ultimate anisotropy, which is a single gravitational wave source. So that is what I'm going to focus on today. And if you want to ask me about the other work that I've done, I'd be very happy to talk to you about it at great length. So let's just get oriented. The gravitational wave spectrum of astronomy is amazing. We have primordial backgrounds at the very low frequency end, pulsar timing arrays in the nanohertz frequency band. The sources for pulsar timing arrays are supermassive black holes and the slow adiabatic in-spiral phase. These supermassive black holes are the biggest black holes in the universe. These are 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 solar masses or bigger, although the larger ones at 10 to the 10 solar masses are rare. And they live in the hearts of galaxies. And when galaxies merge, their supermassive black holes should merge. This seems like a very easy picture, but hopefully I'll disabuse you of that concept very soon. Then you have the space-based gravitational wave detectors, which is like LISA. Apparently the third arm is going to be resurrected. So we don't have to call it ELISA anymore. It's now going to be full LISA again. And the sources here are the baby supermassive black hole binary. So 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar masses. They're interesting in their own right. They suffer from the same physical problems, like the final parsec problem, as the mega supermassive black holes. But I won't really be talking about LISA very much today. And of course, there's LIGO. So LIGO, you have stellar mass black holes. You're in the tens of hertz to kilohertz frequency band, and your sources are these neutron star mergers, neutron star black hole mergers, black hole mergers. So a LIGO likes to advertise that they can measure, you know, this fraction of a proton displacement with pulsar timing arrays. The typical string that we're after is 10 to the minus 15, which is 10 meters per light year. And that really puts us in the frame of mind that pulsar timing arrays are a galactic scale gravitational wave detector, right? This is what we're after, something that's around 10 meters per light year in terms of strain. So what's a pulsar timing array? Well, when galaxies merge, each galaxy has a central supermassive black hole, and when they merge, their black hole should merge if there's any justice in the universe, and the jury's still out on that. So when the black holes are in this merger phase, they're separated by a milliparsec. And they emit gravitational waves in the in frequencies which are greater than around 1 nanohertz, which is the pulsar timing array band. Now again, these are 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 solar mass binaries. You'll only find these in the centers of galaxies. So the gravitational waves are emitted in all directions, and some of them can possibly be detected at the Earth while we're minding our own business timing millisecond pulsars. So millisecond pulsars are nature's perfect clocks. They used to be better than atomic clocks on Earth as timekeepers. So any kind of deviation in the arrival time, a redshift or a blueshift, could signal the presence of gravitational waves. And of course, we have a whole array of pulsars, which means we don't have to just look at one pulsar and see if this is happening. We look at a whole sky full of pulsars to see this kind of behavior. So the pulsar timing array is formed of a collection right now of three major pulsar timing arrays. There's the European pulsar timing array, the Parkes pulsar timing array, and NanoGrav. So I'm currently an active member of the EPTA and NanoGrav, but I have written papers for the Parkes pulsar timing array. And our primary goal is to detect nanohertz gravitational waves. Now, as I said earlier, these nanohertz gravitational waves don't necessarily have to be from supermassive black holes. They can be from primordial backgrounds, but I just don't have enough time today to talk about those. So together, we form the International Pulsar Timing Array. And in our first data release, we released data on 49 millisecond pulsars that were timed with 8 radio telescopes. Now, the reason that we need millisecond pulsars to do this experiment is really quite straightforward. If you take the strain to be this change in time over total observation time, and you know that the strain that we're after is around 10 to the minus 15 from various models, our baselines are order of magnitude 10 years, which means that the timing residuals, or the precision that we're after, is hundreds of nanoseconds. And only millisecond pulsars can give you that kind of timing precision. So that's why we need to have really good millisecond pulsars. Now, one typical millisecond pulsar from NanoGrav is J1713 plus 0747 for the astrophiles in the room, or if you're an aspiring astrophile. This is the right ascension and declination of the pulsar, so its name actually tells you where it is on the sky, which is useful. And this is what the timing residuals look like from this particular pulsar. So when I say it's a typical pulsar, I of course mean it's one of the best ones that we have. So you'll see here that these residuals have very large error bars, and large in terms of microseconds. And there was a back-end upgrade here at the radio telescopes, which really improved things. So the data from here forward are getting much, much better. Now, in order to make a pulsar timing array work, you need to have pulsars. So I've been asked several times if there's any kind of paucity of sufficiently good millisecond pulsars to make this work. And the answer is absolutely not. Now, when Maura McLaughlin gave me this figure last year, there were around 2,300 known pulsars, 230 millisecond pulsars, with around 30,000 more left to discover. And the ones that we have discovered already are not necessarily even the best ones. So there could be even better millisecond pulsars waiting for us to discover. Now here, this is the figure from the IPTA data release. You have millisecond pulsars, which are not being timed by the IPTA as these little crosses, and the ones that are being timed by the IPTA as the big stars. So these are, again, 49 millisecond pulsars with all their data being put together to look for nanohertz gravitational wave signals.
Yeah, you mentioned that there are many more pulsars than what have been followed, and there will be a lot more discovered pretty soon. So you mentioned that you need a baseline of over 10 years, but can you do better or for us well if you just consider whole bunch of pulsars over 1 year, so can you do statistics the other way around?
So you need at least a 5-year baseline in order to, so you're kind of thinking of parallelizing a pulsar timing array, but you need at least a 5-year baseline in order to get something that's good enough for a pulsar timing array. Now the quality of the pulsar depends on what kind of signal you're looking for. For a gravitational wave background, it's okay to have good millisecond pulsars that cover the entire sky. But if you're looking for single sources, continuous gravitational wave sources, then the best thing to do is to have excellent pulsars in the direction of the source. And I'm going to talk about that in just a little bit, and I'll leave. Again, at least five years. So NanoGrav has a timing program where we continuously add millisecond pulsars to NanoGrav around 4 or 5 a year, being conservative. And that makes sure that you're continuously increasing the baseline of the array. So you always have some pulsars which are now becoming useful, which weren't useful before, and extending the reach of the pulsar timing array.
The best constellation which I've been after, does that come from this guy?
The
best constellation graph which I've amplitude.
The best gravitational wave amplitude? Oh, the best constraint is from the Parkes pulsar timing array, and that's around 1 times 10 to the minus 15, and so they're timed pulsars in the southern hemisphere. So the IPTA...
Is that this guy or is it different one?
So this is everyone together.
No, but you had one on the top, J1713.
This is a NanoGrav pulsar.
That's a NanoGrav.
Yeah, this is a nanograph pulsar. So these are our radio telescopes. So the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array uses the Parkes Telescope in Australia. And we may actually be getting access to a Deep Space Network telescope from NASA, which is why we're spending some time at JPL, because they use these telescopes to talk to, say, you know, the Mars rovers and things like that. And if the telescope is parked somewhere and it's not communicating with something for 5 minutes, 5 minutes is an eternity for a millisecond pulsar. So we can time pulsars in that part of the sky. So in that way, we're kind of being parasitic and taking up all of the time, or maybe opportunistic, and timing pulsars when it's just not doing anything. So in the EPTA, there's the Effelsberg Telescope, Westerbork in the Netherlands, Nancy in France, the Sardinia Radio Telescope in Italy, and then there's the Lovell Telescope at Jodrell Bank, and in the US, there's the Green Bank Telescope and Arecibo. So there's also the GMRT in India, which is sometimes used to do 24-hour observing campaigns of certain pulsars. But in terms of pulsar timing arrays, it's not currently a member of any of the pulsar timing arrays. Another interesting way of doing pulsar timing is by following up Fermi sources. Because of the way that millisecond pulsars evolve, they spend a certain amount of time emitting gamma rays, and those can be detected with Fermi and then followed up with a radio telescope. So it kind of tells you where you should look on the sky to find more millisecond pulsars. And so far, there have been 43 millisecond pulsars that have been detected and followed up this way. So that's another interesting route to finding good millisecond pulsars. So the future is large. With CHIME, we can do pulsar timing, and the CHIME prototype, the Pathfinder, is up and running. There's the FAST radio telescope, which is 500 meters across. In China, they had to move a whole village that was at the center here before. I'm not sure how much they were given for a relocation allowance, but they built it in the same kind of karst landscape that Arecibo is built in, so one may mistake it for Arecibo. And then there's the SKA, right? And the square kilometer array will be the best tool that we have for pulsar timing arrays and gravitational wave detection. Meerkat is the Pathfinder in South Africa, and the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy, where I'm based right now, is currently building the receiver that will do the pulsar timing for this instrument. So Canada is already playing a key role in the future of this nanohertz gravitational wave detection effort through CHIME and then through its contribution to the square kilometer array. So I'll tell you a little bit now about the gravitational wave background. So, like any good physics project, it's hard, and you have to make some simplifying assumptions. So if we assume that the supermassive black hole binaries are in circular orbits and that they're driven to coalescence by emitting gravitational waves, you can write down this really easy back-of-the-envelope formula. So you have this characteristic strain, which is the superposition of all of the gravitational waves which have ever been emitted in galaxy mergers, right? All of the gravitational waves you integrate over all chert mass, over all redshift, and the frequency part decouples and comes out into the front, but you still have this big gory mess, which tells you what the characteristic strain is of the background. Now, an interesting and relatively open question is, what is this? This is the number of merger remnants per co-moving volume, or the merger rate of galaxies. And while we have some handles on that from large-scale simulations like Alestris, or even the Millennium simulations through the halos, we don't really know what this is. And so what happens is when you take the characteristic strain, the frequency is nicely out in the front. This takes the square root, and you have a minus two-thirds frequency dependence. You report this at a frequency, a reference frequency of 1/1 year, and all of this is the amplitude of the gravitational wave background, which means that if you measure the amplitude of the background, you can then get a handle on what's going on underneath the hood in terms of the galaxy mergers. So if you're a cosmologist, you may prefer to think of this in terms of omega GW, which is gravitational wave energy density, right? And that's proportional to the characteristic strain squared. So it all comes down to this. But again, this is assuming circular binaries. And you can add in different dependencies if you have eccentric binaries. So when you think about gravitational wave backgrounds, it's hard to think about something that's equivalent to a waveform. If you're looking for gravitational waves, people often think of the kind of chirping whoop, type LIGO waveform. But for backgrounds, you don't have a particular waveform. What you have is something called an overlap reduction function, which is the correlation that's induced by the gravitational waves interacting with the pulsars in the Earth. So this is called the Hellings and Downs curve. And it's a point-by-point correlation function that depends on the angular separation of your pulsar pairs. And so in reality, what I've done here, this is only a curve because I've assumed a kind of, you know, infinite sampling of this curve, and I've written down every single point to draw a curve, but it's not. It's really a point-by-point function, which depends on that angular separation. So if you have pulsars that are separated by 20 degrees, by 30 degrees, by 40 degrees, they're all different points on this curve. And as you add more and more pulsars to the pulsar timing array, you get the Hellings and Downs curve in the limit of perfect sampling of the curve. And so any detection of the background would likely need to produce this kind of smoking gun signature. And now the Hellings and Downs curve makes a lot of simplifying assumptions too. When you write this down, you assume that the background is isotropic. Is it? You assume that general relativity is your theory of gravity, which has only two polarizations. Is that right? Right? You also assume that if you do have your background, say that you have breathing modes from an alternative theory, that that is isotropic. So there's also anisotropic, non-GR type backgrounds. So all of this stuff is built in to this overlap reduction function, which is why I'm just going to go over this very briefly. The overlap reduction function depends on the antenna beam pattern, right? So this FA, FB, so this is pulsar A and pulsar B. And I've written down a diagram here, which just shows you the geometry of this. So you have pulsar A at some distance LA and pulsar B at some distance LB. Omega hat is the direction of gravitational wave propagation. M cross N gives you omega. So here you have the antenna beam pattern, which depends intrinsically on this 1 plus omega hat dot P term. And what's interesting, as I'm sure a lot of people are doing in their heads right now, is, well, what happens when this is equal to minus 1? Right? What happens? The answer is the pulsar term here saves you, and it gives you 0. And that's because the signal at the pulsar will be the same as the signal at the Earth due to this gravitational wave surfing effect. In reality, this will probably not happen. And when that doesn't happen, you get a huge increase in sensitivity, which means you're really sensitive to pulsars, which are right in front but maybe slightly next to supermassive black holes that are merging. So you should be able to see further behind your best pulsars due to this geometric effect. So the two main features of this overlap reduction function is this angular power distribution, P of omega hat, which for Hellings and Downs is isotropic, so you can call this Y00, it can be constant, and the antenna beam pattern. KAB, this kappa term, is the difference between the Earth term and the pulsar term. So the Earth term is the gravitational wave perturbation at the Earth, and the pulsar term is the perturbation at the pulsar. And while the photon does get continuously deformed by the gravitational wave on its way to Earth, when you do that integral, what falls out is literally just the pulsar term minus the Earth term, which is really nice. So because we choose a reference frame with us at the center, the reference frame for the Earth term is at an L equals 0, which gives us 1. And the pulsar term is at some constant offset. So let me just put this into terms of this particular reference frame here to show you exactly what I mean. If you solve the, sorry, the word just flew out of my head. the, oh my gosh, so E plus IJ. in terms of MI and NI and IJ, and you have, you choose your coordinate system like I did here, you can actually set the F cross term to be equal to zero, which is nice, and then that's one less integral to solve. And the F plus term is equal to something very simple, minus 1/2, 1 minus cos theta. In order to get the Hellings and Downs curve, all you do is you take this, you multiply it by your angular power distribution, you integrate over theta and phi, that's the Hellings and Downs curve, right? And so a lot of the underlying physics of the Hellings and Downs curve is really quite easy mathematically. All you have to do to get alternative theories of gravity is to change your detector response, and to get anisotropy, you change the angular power distribution of the background. So why do we expect there to be anisotropy in the background, and really, how do we go after? Well, again, the residuals are proportional to this overlap reduction function. And while most people are probably used to seeing anisotropy on very small scales or large L, the gravitational wave background anisotropy is probably quite large. Any anisotropy in the background is likely due to hotspots of gravitational waves. So if you have a very large group of galaxies and they're emitting gravitational waves, this could manifest itself as a hotspot on the sky. So we don't really know that the gravitational wave background is isotropic. And the good news is that there's no need to assume that it is, because we can do searches for anisotropy and constrain if there's any power in these higher multiple moments. And eventually, when the background is detected, we can say how isotropic is the background, which is also interesting. So when you do this and you move from the Hellings and Downs curve, which was written down for the first time in 1983, and then no one looked at it for 30 years until I was like, what if it's not isotropic, right? Which is a really kind of straightforward question, but there you go. This is what it looks like for dipoles. These are your new correlation functions, your quadrupoles. You can go on for as long as you like here. And these are, interestingly, all distinct from the Hellings and Downs curve. So each one of these spherical harmonics that goes into these backgrounds will have its own weight function. And so you'll have a certain percent of the background, which is isotropic, and then some more power in the higher multiple moments. So this is the first map of potential anisotropy in nanograv, which I'm leading for the collaboration right now. And you'll see that the nanograv limit is 1.5 times 10 to the minus 15, 1.5 times 10 to the minus 15, which is blue. So there's no sign of anisotropy so far. This is a very blue sky. But also, we don't expect there to be. There's no theory so far that says that you should see some sort of hard hot spot on the sky before detecting something like an isotropic background. So literally, what I'm trying to say is that the anisotropy method is really to, you know, cover ourselves to make sure that we're not automatically discounting things. We don't know what's out there. And this is one really good way of trying to find out. So this is, we take the background and we decompose it on a basis of the spherical harmonics. So exactly, so this is using the nanograv data. So there's maybe a better illustration is this one, where I take the angular power spectrum in a kind of CMB style way. So my colleague Steve Taylor and I did this in 2015 for the EPTA data. And we go up to L equals 4 because that's the current angular resolution of pulsar timing arrays. They're very large patches of the sky. It's about 500 square degrees for astronomers, or L equals 4 is still very large. We found that you can hide 40% of the signal in these higher multiple moments, which means that the background, as we know it right now, we just constrain the level of anisotropy to be less than 40%. And I did a similar study for nanograv, and this is around 32%. And so the more that we can constrain the level of anisotropy, the more certain we can be that the background is isotropic and there aren't kind of gravitational wave hotspots nearby that we might be missing when we're doing the isotropic analysis. And that brings me to my next item, which is, I think, probably one of the coolest projects that I've ever worked on. So it's been really, really fun to do this. And it's looking for these ultimate anisotropies, these continuous wave sources. Now, even though my colleagues consider me to be a theorist, I still like to think that I've got my feet on the ground. And if galaxies merging, right, are where these supermassive black holes are, we can point to that in the sky, right? You should be able to point to, you know, potential supermassive black hole binary sources on the sky. We have galaxy catalogs, right? Astronomers have been doing this for ages. So why not just use galaxy catalogs to try to find supermassive black hole host galaxies? That's really what this project is about. Now, one of the big hurdles, maybe, we don't really know, is the final parsec problem. And there's deliberately a question sign there, because we don't actually know if it's a problem. Numerical relativists don't seem to think it's a problem. But if you ask Scott Tremaine, then yeah, people think that it is a big problem. So let me tell you what it is. When the galaxies merge, the central supermassive black hole binaries can sink to this new galactic potential, but they don't merge. They can get to one parsec separation. That's 3 light years apart. And it takes longer than the age of the universe for them to merge if they only emit gravitational waves, right? So it's possible, if the universe has a really contrived sense of humor, that all of these big galaxies have stalled supermassive black hole binaries in the center. Now, this is a kind of zeroth order explanation, because everyone knows that at the centers of galaxies, you don't just have nothing, right? You don't have supermassive black holes in a vacuum. You have gas, you have stars, there's a lot of things happening. And what happens is when, for example, stars cross the orbit of this binary, it can get slingshot out and carry away angular momentum and energy. And if enough stars get slingshot out, binary shrinks every single time, and you can get the binary to the point where it's emitting gravitational waves efficiently enough to merge within a Hubble time. And usually the time scale in the pulsar timing array band is 25 million years. You're never going to miss a supermassive black hole merging, right? The time to coalescence of a 2×10⁹ solar mass binary from 1 nanohertz is 26 mega years. So once it crosses the threshold, then it can eventually merge, and supermassive black holes will merge in the LISA band, but we'll see this early part of the in-spiral in the pulsar timing array band. Now you can make a similar argument for gas disks, which are around the binary. If there's an accretion disk, that'll also torque the binary again, you get rid of angular momentum, binary shrinks, and it can merge. If we don't see a gravitational wave background by 2019, it's possible that a large fraction of supermassive black holes don't merge, which is a really interesting result. So the main idea for this project is that galaxy mergers yield these large elliptical galaxies, and we're therefore likely to see supermassive black hole host galaxies, right? And we could point to them in the sky. They should be there, they should be there, they should be there. This isn't a mystery. What is a mystery is which galaxies are the likeliest to host these supermassive black hole binaries. How do we figure this out? And what's the time to detection of these sources? So I start with the 2-mass galaxy catalog, and 2-mass is the 2-micron all-sky survey. So it's this near-infrared wavelength, and it's a recognized standard in the field. It's managed by IPAC at Caltech. And it's sensitive to the dominant mass component of these galaxies, which is why we use this particular wavelength. So I look at elliptical and lenticular galaxies, which are likely formed from mergers. And then you can convert the luminosity to a bulge mass using this simple formula. So I find that there are 5,110 galaxies out to 225 megaparsecs, which is the completeness limit of this survey. So how many of those are going to host supermassive black holes that are in the pulsar timing array band? Well, the first thing that we need to do is then convert from a bulge mass to a supermassive black hole mass. And to do that, we use an empirical scaling law And this is called MM bulge. It's the scaling law that's empirically measured between the black hole mass and the mass of the bulge of the galaxy. So here we have a whole bunch of galaxies, and you have this scaling law, which goes between all of these. Now, the scaling law has a scatter, epsilon, and you can see that at the high mass end, it looks like it's breaking down, right? It doesn't look like it really holds at these high masses. And so for very massive galaxies, there's usually another way to measure the black hole mass, and in that case, it's exactly what I do. I'll take a dynamically measured black hole mass over inferring it from this kind of scaling law. And I do log normal draws here, again, in order to be conservative for the mass of the black hole. So this allows me to convert between the bulge mass of the galaxy and a possible total mass of the supermassive black hole, right? Because what we're trying to get down to is eventually the strain. So I just want to remind you of these timescales, right? First of all, you'll notice that this is a cartoon. It's pieced together bit by bit, where we have a kiloparsec scale separated binary. So right after the galaxies merge, you're in this moment of pairing of the black holes. And here the black holes are being driven by dynamical friction. Then you have the parsec scale, where you might have the final parsec problem or not. Nobody really knows. And then eventually you get to the merger timescale if this is solved. So here the electromagnetic counterpart would be an active galactic nucleus. And there's lots of stunning pictures of these. And here you have gravitational wave events. But this isn't a self-consistent model, right? This is even a kind of shoddy cartoon, because there is currently no way of going through this completely self-consistently. So we have to piece together all these different regimes. So what I want to know is, what's the probability of a supermassive black hole binary being in the pulsar timing array band, which means what's the probability of having a supermassive black hole binary here in the pulsar timing array band over this total sum of these timescales, dynamical friction, stellar hardening, and gravitational wave emission, this TZ. Right? And that's exactly what I've written down here. Right? The probability is the time to coalescence of the binary. So how long does it spend in the PTA band over this total time? Right? And then what is the merger rate of those kinds of galaxies, and how long has it been going for? So you get this figure here from the illustrious simulation. So here I use the merger rates from Rodriguez-Gomez et al. And the total number of galaxies that have supermassive black hole binaries in the pulsar timing ray band is a sum of all of these probabilities. Now, if this timescale, this TZ, which is dynamical friction, hardening, and gravitational wave emission timescale, if that's larger than 12.5 gigayears, the binary is stalled, right? You're not going to get it to merge after 12.5 gigayears. Also, this is the limit to which the reported fitting function in Rodriguez-Gomez et al. Is valid to, which is a redshift of 4. So you can't use it past then. But also, we don't expect to have supermassive black holes starting to merge at a redshift of 4. So there's a lot of good reasons for thinking this. So if the time scale is larger than this, we say that the binary has stalled. So the first result from this project is that there are, on average, 90 galaxies per realization. I did 75,000 realizations, and there are, on average, about 90 galaxies out of the 5,000 in 2 mass that are hosting supermassive black holes emitting gravitational waves in the pulsar timing array band. That doesn't mean that they're detectable. It means that they have a frequency that's greater than 1 nanohertz. And we might eventually get there with the sensitivities, with the strain sensitivity increase. But this is the first big result, that there's about 90 binaries at any given time within 225 megaparsecs, which in terms of pulsar timing arrays is right next door. The next is the number of stalled binaries. How many times did I have a timescale that was essentially a Hubble time? And that was around 7. 7 times, 7 galaxies out of the 5,000 had stalled binaries in it. So this is the first time that we can constrain the stall fraction of binaries from using this kind of reasoning and for continuous gravitational wave sources.
Okay, but isn't that Mallon dependent? So, okay, the last parsec problem says that they're all the stall.
Well, so it depends on the underlying if it can go through dynamical friction timescales and the hardening timescales within a Hubble time, right?
So you're assuming that it can go through.
Well, so there's what I didn't have time to show is the underlying, like how those are calculated.
Yeah.
And those are calculated depending on the mass of the galaxy, the mass in stars, and the velocity dispersion of those stars. And so that can sometimes give you a stalled binary, but most of the time you get to the gravitational wave merger phase. So only, you know, 10 to the minus 3 times do you never get there.
But that's the byproduct of the model you
put. So you're right, that the model I used was the illustrious merger rate. And what I'll show you in my future directions part of the talk is how we can improve this, right?
How but in addition to merger rate is how, I mean, how the orbits are shrinking. And the merger rate just tells you how galaxies merge.
Yeah, but so how the binary shrinks is then due to this interaction with the gas and stars or possible eccentricity of the binaries. And so in this model, I assume the stellar hardening mechanism, the ejecting of stars, and that was responsible for overcoming the final parsec problem. In reality, you can have eccentricity, you can have gas, you can have all three. You can even have, well, I'll talk about this a little bit later. There's a lot of ways to overcome this problem. And so then which sources can be detected is the big question, right? And also, should we have already detected something if this model is correct? So we already have the black hole mass from the catalogs. We have the distance to the sources. We don't have the mass ratio of the binary Q. And so in order to calculate the strain, we need both frequency and mass ratio. So I'll draw a Q from a log normal distribution between 0.25 and 1. And 0.25 here is the lower bound because this is an astronomy term for a major merger. So we expect these to come from major mergers, and this is, excuse me, the mass ratio of a major merger.
But I thought there were arguments out there that the typical mass ratio in mergers would be more 1/10, 1/30.
Well, so this is for this is for major mergers. What you're talking about are minor mergers, and extreme mass ratio mergers are in the LISA band.
No, I'm not talking about that. Extreme mass ratio. Binary merger between Q close to zero. I'm saying Q close to one, between 1/10 and 1/30.
Well, so those aren't considered in this kind of galaxy merger model because here it's assuming two massive galaxies have a major merger. But this can easily be done for different choices of Q, absolutely.
But this is roughly saying that if you have two massive galaxies coming together, you're assuming the mass of the individual galaxies more than a factor of 4.
So, well, so actually, in the illustrious merger simulation, you marginalize or average over the mass ratio of the galaxies, and that's the particular form of dN by dt that I used. Because you're right, I don't have access to this mass ratio, and in reality, these major mergers are rare. The typical merger rates that you would put in for dN by dt is something like 0.1 mergers per giga-year. And those are the kind of numbers that we are putting in. So you're right, it is rare. And that is taken into account.
I think there's probably a different answer to your question also from a cosmological point of view. So that, I mean, the tiny galaxies don't actually end up in the center. They just end up at the outskirts because there's no dynamical friction that pushes them to the center, pulls them to the center.
Yeah, but it's still not small. It's in the 10 to 1 mass difference between two galaxies coming together. That's not a huge difference.
Well, I'm saying that in order to have this, in order to have a self-consistent model here, in order to use the merger rates that I'm using in this kind of particular model, I need to have major mergers.
I was thinking there is a paper by Paul Miller deciding what would be the typical mass ratio in supermassive binary black hole mergers.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion was 1/10 to 1/30 mass divided by 2. And then it's memory.
Well, you're right in that this is a particular subset of more general models, and it would be really straightforward to change the sampling of the mass ratio here, but we'd also have to take into account that you'd be looking at different kinds of galaxies, and I'm not doing that at the moment, but that's definitely something that I'm thinking about doing. Okay, so the which sources would we have detected with the EPTA, right? Which sources should we have seen? Is non-detection surprising? So in these 75,000 realizations of the universe, only 130 sources should have been detected by EPTA, which means that it had less than a 1% chance of detecting anything in this two-mass volume, right? So here, in order to set your expectance for the scheme, this is the galactic center here. And these orange stars are the pulsars, the six best EPTA pulsars. And you can see that the detector response of the pulsars is responsible for really exposing a huge number of galaxies over here. This is where you can see the furthest is behind these six best EPTA pulsars. And over here, they're not as good. And the size of the circle also tells you how large the strain is relative to the other sources. And so here, these are really loud sources, right? And they have to be super loud in order to be detected because they're in a part of the sky that doesn't have very good pulsars, right? So you have to have really huge and very rare events. So again, you can really see that where the pulsars are in the sky really matters, right? You can really see a lot further when you're using actual maps of gravitational wave sensitivity versus a sky-averaged strain sensitivity. And sky-averaged strain looks like this, right? This is the kind of typical gravitational wave sensitivity curve you're used to looking at. But this is when you average over all the different sky positions. And so in order to tell you how bad this is, these red dots are all the sources that I found by using sky maps. And this is what the sky average sensitivity looks like, right? So if I'd only used the sky average sensitivity curve, I would have missed out on about four times the number of sources, right? So that's how important the pulsar locations are in the sky, so you can see much further in parts of the sky where you have the best pulsars. And again, this is due to the detector response of the pulsars. So now you're probably asking, what's the time to detection, right, of any of these sources? Oh, one more thing about anisotropy. So because I have this very strong background in doing these CMB type calculations for the gravitational wave background, a natural question was, what if I take all of these single sources and turn them into a background and then look at their angular power spectrum, right? So here I have one particular realization of the sky that had two detected sources in it, these purple dots. And then I say that the characteristic strain is the sum of these particular, of each strain in quadrature times the frequency over some observing time, which it took to be 15 years. And then if you take the whole sky and look at its angular power spectrum, it gives you this, which at first glance you might think first source, second source, right? But actually it's a beating of the two sources against each other because they're very close to each other on the sky. If you remove one source and then run it again, you get the green curve. And if you remove the other one, you get the red curve. And if you remove both of the very loud sources, you get this kind of background noise. But this background noise is at the level of around 10% of the background, of the isotropic background. Because here, I take the CL decompositions where I have all the CLMs as weights, and I normalize it to the C0 component. So these are all multiples of the isotropic C0 component. And so this is a level of about 10% if there's no single source in the sky. And then if you do have detectable sources, they make themselves known. So you can possibly find sources this way. Or at least as a first pass, you can see what the angular power spectrum looks like, maybe localize it to a large patch of the sky, and then do a directed search in that particular hotspot. So the time to detection of these sources depends. So there's a 25-year estimate. So right now, we're somewhere between 10 and 15 years. It's really hard to compare the different timescales of different pulsar timing arrays because nanograv goes from a particular fixed date, like from 2006 to 2016, would be a 10-year data set for nanograv. The EPTA uses the longest baseline of one pulsar to report a data set. So if one pulsar has an 18-year baseline, that's an 18-year data set. But some of the pulsars only have 7-year observations in it, so it can become really tricky really quickly. So right now, we're between 10 and 15 years. So in 10 years from now, is when we'll start to be probing this really dense space of sources, right? Now, these are all of the realizations that it put on the sky. And this is the pessimistic sensitivity curve. So this is if you have a lot of red noise in your pulsars. If you don't have that nice white residuals that I showed you earlier, and you have a kind of long-term trend in there that's red noise, that can really wreck your chances of detecting anything. But if they're nice and white, then you get the optimistic sensitivity curve. And so the truth is somewhere in between these two things, right?
How about the chime turns on, you get to see thousands of pulsars, some of those are excellent. Is it within 5 years? Can you show me 10-year horizon?
So with chime, chime is a very low-frequency radio telescope. And so chime will give you a handle on what the dispersion measure in the pulsars is. And that can help you to remove that particular noise source. But chime on its own, without other radio telescopes, is not the best thing for timing pulsars, because pulsars are brighter at the higher frequencies, so in like the gigahertz, whereas chime is more like in the hundreds of megahertz frequency band.
No, I forget about chime now, and I happen to discover 10 more, 100 more excellent pulsars.
Yeah.
Can you not shorten the 10-year horizon?
Yes. So first thing I want to say is that these curves assume, first of all, that there is a planned upgrade in Arecibo in 2018, which is currently planned, and that will whiten the timing residuals a little bit, and that we're also adding 4 pulsars per year with 300 nanosecond timing residuals, which is conservative for nanograv. That's perfectly reasonable. And we're also sampling pulsars in parts of the sky that are in the horizon of Arecibo and GBT. So this is a really realistic time to detection in terms of that. That we've taken all of the information that you have on the current millisecond pulsars and evolved it into the future, and then added more pulsars, which could realistically be detected by the nanograv telescopes, and then, you know, fast forwarded. And so this is extremely pessimistic, and this is optimistic, and I think that some numbers will help to clarify. Yeah.
The blue points, they are just from the whole universe? Is that?
They're from two mass. Everything
just
is
from two mass.
Just from two mass.
But that is so many points into art.
So this is all of the realizations, right? So this is, each realization gives you about 90 sources, and then this is done 75,000 times.
Wow.
So this is about 90 times 75,000, which is why these numbers are probably more instructive when it comes to detection probability.
So you're just looking at two mass galaxies, but there are many, many, many other stuff farther away from.
Absolutely,
galaxies.
Absolutely.
So
this
you
is.
Think it helps to actually know where the galaxies are? Does that make much of a difference?
It does, because of where the pulsars are, right?
Right, but I mean, we don't have too much angular sensitivity, so.
But if you, for example, if someone claims to find a galaxy with, you know, a supermassive black hole binary in the pulsar timing array band, if it's currently not in our sensitivity, we can look for example, Fermi sources around it, follow them up, find pulsars, and then constrain it within 5 to 10 years. Right.
Wow.
So we can build our own pulsar timing array in that sense if we have something that we really want to go after.
Yeah. Right, so I guess I'm just wondering that whether if you don't have a galaxy server, you're just looking for
blind searches would be difficult. Absolutely, I think we can do 30% better if we know where the galaxy is on the sky.
But because there's much more volume where we don't have galaxies, so let me say the two factors that yes, like it's less blind if you know where the galaxy is, but most of the galaxies are where we don't see most of the galaxies. Right now, so.
Well, I'm going to talk about this towards the end of the talk, where I talk about extending these galaxy surveys, and then I'll talk about that in just a second. So in terms of time to detection, it depends on what you want your false alarm probability to be. Two sigma events come and go, so that's really not fascinating for many people. Three sigma and then 1 × 10⁻⁴ is really your kind of gold-plated detection. Everyone will believe this. So if you have 95% detection probability with these false alarm probabilities for 15, 20, and 25 years, you have the white noise answer in front and the red noise answer in the brackets. So for example, in 25 years, there's essentially 100% chance that we'll at least see something at the 2 sigma level from 2 mass, right? And that's 10 years from now. And if there's a lot of red noise, then that falls by essentially 2 orders of magnitude, right? So we're hugely sensitive to the red noise in the pulsar. It's 0.8%, right? If you look for something instead, if you want to be a bit more constraining and have a 3 sigma event in 2 mass in 25 years, that chance is about 50% for white noise, and again, much less for red noise, and again, for the gold-plated detection. Now, what this doesn't take into account is the position of the pulsars on the sky. You'll remember that when I used only the sky average sensitivity curves, like the ones I showed you up here, that you missed out on about 4 times of the sources because you didn't take into account where they were on the sky. And when you put in that factor of 4, this can easily be 100%, right? And so you really win from knowing where the galaxies are and having pulsars in the right parts of the sky. Now, you're right in that we might not know where they are a priori, but if we do, then we can really go after them. So again, the current PTA data set is between 10 and 15 years, and we need 25 years in order to get these kinds of results in 2 mass. So this is the false alarm probability. If you have a 2 sigma, 3 sigma event, or something like.
What are the percentages?
So this is the number of, I'll rewind this. So this is the number, say, of sources which lie above the sensitivity curve divided by the total number that are there, right?
So if it's about 100% it just means 1, right? Well,
yeah.
Can you use what? So if we're talking about 25 years, can you use 20?
Sorry?
In 20 years,
yeah.
Lisa was a clone.
No. In 20, that's in 5 years from now.
Oh, I see. So you need 10 years.
We already have essentially 15 years.
Okay.
Right? I was trying to.
Sure.
But you're right. If that was 25 years from now, I would be studying something else. Yeah. So this is, so again, something like 48% is that, given where the sensitivity curves are on the sky. I plotted the 10⁻⁴ curves here, but I actually have all of these curves for all of these different time scales. It just makes a really busy looking plot, which I'm happy to show you later if you want. So what are the sources that I found the most often, right? What are the sources that maybe we should follow up? Because these are real galaxies. And the number one galaxy was the Sombrero Galaxy, which is kind of a question mark, right? You're like, why? Why would I choose the Sombrero Galaxy? I'll get to that in a second. The second one was the Spindle Galaxy, NGC 3115, followed by M84. This one doesn't have another name. Another Messier catalog one, 4NaxA and M85. Now, it turns out that the reason we don't see galaxies like M87 is that they're too massive. The time to coalescence is really fast in terms of pulsar timing array scales. So the chance of catching it during the gravitational wave in spiral are small compared to something which is in this kind of Goldilocks zone for gravitational waves, which is massive enough to give you a signal, but is not so massive that it evolves too quickly through the pulsar timing array band for us to catch it. So clues for electromagnetic counterparts. These are some statistics from the realizations that I did. So the distance to the galaxies that were detected with the 25-year data set, there was a spike here around Virgo. But really, there were still galaxies that were detected out to 200 megaparsecs. So the closer ones we found more often, which is what we would expect. But I think that we should still go further. Again, the chert mass, right, is peaked at at around between 9 and 9.25 in the log of its chert mass. And that again makes it so that the binary isn't so massive that it evolves right through the band and we don't catch it in the PTA band. So you can be too massive, right? And that's the problem with M87. The mass ratio from the binaries that we detected the most was around 0.25. But again, this was also sampled log normally. And the average strain is peaked here at around, on a log scale, 10 to the minus 15, right? So we didn't really detect really loud, you know, singularly huge events. We mostly detected the fainter ones with the 25-year data set. But did I do this twice? I'm sorry. So one of the really interesting clues for following these up is the distribution of the K-band luminosity, because this is actually what's in the galaxy catalogs. And so then I can tell you the range of K-band luminosities of the ideal supermassive black hole binary host galaxy. And this is something that you can give to an astronomer to do new surveys with and follow-ups with. So it really helps to inform.
They call it the K-band magnitude,
yeah. So what are the future directions for the field in my last few minutes? So absolutely, I think that we should extend these surveys. So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey will give you is the deepest survey that we have with these galaxies. And what I plan to do is take it out to redshift of 0.3. And I do that because these illustrious galaxy model people claim that most of the gravitational wave background comes from sources at a redshift of 0.3. But because we now have these tools to do this analysis, I can just look for those sources. I can, you know, crank the gear again. I can make backgrounds, and I can say what the background is from those galaxies. Now, again, two masses in all sky. It's a little sliver of the sky, about a fifth of the sky. So then, you know, you have to find a way to average this over the whole sky. But it'll give you a good clue. I'm going to add more complexity to these models. I can add eccentricity, gas interactions, and the stellar hardening interplay. It could be that the binaries don't really interact directly that much with the gas and the stars, but that the gas and the stars drive the eccentricity of the binary, and that's what drives it to merge. So we can study that. These here are realizations of galaxies out to redshift of about 0.3, and these are all different sources that Alberto Cesana generated, which are evolved under different assumptions. So this is gravitational wave only. You can see that this is our current survey limit here. You have, you know, your few sources, but when you start to add the final parsec physics like gas and stellar hardening, you have fewer and fewer sources. So again, this really motivates looking further to find more sources and to making these models a little bit more sophisticated. Also, like I said earlier, when we want to do electromagnetic follow-ups, we need to have a clue of what to look for. And again, it seems like there's a Goldilocks zone for the chert mass where it's not too massive, and also for the K-band luminosity. There's also new X-ray data which could have signatures of supermassive black hole mergers in it. And I alluded to this earlier, that you can essentially build your own pulsar timing array. If you find galaxies that you think host binaries, you can put pulsars, you can try to find pulsars in parts of the sky by using Fermi candidates to build your own pulsar timing array. Another interesting direction I think we should take is developing an extragalactic pulsar timing array. The Large Magellanic Cloud has pulsars in it. No millisecond pulsars have been found yet, but if you can find millisecond pulsars there, you can watch the evolution of supermassive black hole binaries over 48 kiloparsecs. And so I've done this previously over 1 kiloparsec, which is around 3,000 light years, where you can, you know, concatenate all of these different observations together to make a waveform. And if you're interested in this, I'll talk about this with you offline. But 48.5 kiloparsecs will really give you a handle and might even help you transition between a stellar hardening phase and a gravitational wave detection phase, right? So this can really give you a lot of interesting information.
Sorry, when you say EM follow-ups, what EM mechanism are you thinking about?
So, you know, sometimes you get things like the Catalina All Sky Survey, and they'll say that they find periodic features in some of their sources, and that they attribute those periodic features to supermassive black holes, because you'll never be able to actually see them. They're separated by a milliparsec. You can't see that from the Earth. And so they look for these other kind of secondary features that are in, for example, accretion disks. Also, for X-rays, you can get things like a double K-alpha line. There's very specific things that you can look for and then try to follow it up with these sources. So finally, Lisa is not supposed to be called ELISA anymore, but it's Lisa. And a lot of the methods that I developed for pulsar timing arrays can also be applied to LISA sources. They're just supermassive black holes with different masses. But there's a lot of work that you can do to translate those results into the LISA band. You can also use the anisotropy method I developed to characterize the white dwarf foreground and perhaps better subtract it. And since this is launching in maybe 2034, there's a lot of time to work on this. Also, for primordial backgrounds, you can search for evidence for anisotropic inflation by looking for a dipole in the gravitational wave background, for example. And because we are a few minutes over, I'll just leave my summaries here and take any questions.
Questions? So if you're particularly sensitive to individual supermassive black hole binaries in a certain patch of the sky where you have your best pulsars, does it make sense for people to focus their survey efforts in those areas, and how large would these patches then be?
What kind of surveys? Do you mean
optical, X-ray, whatever?
In order to do binary searching?
To find the kinetic counterpart that can inform you about the potential source that you
Yes,
can
absolutely it does.
Find.
And also using the characteristics that I showed in terms of the kind of optimal chirp mass and the optimal K-band luminosity, you can look for these. And also this hit list, right, are my top 15 galaxies. We should definitely try to go after these to see if maybe there is a binary in them and do targeted searches, because they're the ones that showed up the most often. One thing that I wanted to show you, just in case you're still confused by the case of M87, is M87 first of all has 9.6 cents under the 9 solar mass binary solar mass black hole in it, right? But the probability of choosing it is really low, because the mass of the black hole is so big. So you can think about this in terms of time to coalescence or the frequency evolution. But something like M104, which is a Sombrero galaxy, is always chosen with a higher probability because it spends more time in the pulsar timing array band. And
yeah, just going back to this question of like defining a major merger having a mass ratio of 1/4.
To one, yeah.
Yeah, 1/4 to one. So I assume that's a somewhat arbitrary number. So just because you're assuming a log normal distribution in the mass ratio, and you're getting most of your events at the lower end of that mass ratio.
Yeah, I think like, that there, that's
how
what.
How much does it change if you just do 1/8 instead of 1/4 or something like that? Define that to be a major representation.
Well, in order to have this kind of self-consistent model, the merger rates that I'm using are merger rates from Illustris, which assume mass ratios of the progenitor galaxies to be greater than 1/4, because it follows this somewhat arbitrary definition. And so I'd have to change that and then lower the mass ratio, but it's totally doable. There's a lot of kind of open and shut modifications that you can do. And also I'll be making this code available on GitHub for anyone to use so they can turn all the knobs that they want.
But do you anticipate that would change the...
I don't think it'll change the detection, because the detection really depends, the strain strongly depends on the chirp mass to the 5/3. And so the smaller the chirp, the smaller the mass ratio, right? The smaller the chirp mass, and so you won't find those sources anyway.
But you're only up principles up to 225 megaparsecs, so it's not going to be a significant effect. And on the other hand, you're going to be gaining, the binary will be at that frequency for much longer.
Yes.
So I think at that, 225 megaparsecs, I don't think it's going to be a major effect. If anything's going to happen, I think that's what we're really talking about.
I'm not sure that it'll help significantly, but it's definitely something that we can look into. But you're right that this is a very small volume because this is the first time that we've done this kind of survey. And so by extending the results with, example, SDSS, we'll get a much better handle on how these things work over much larger volumes.
So I guess I still don't understand how having a survey helps, because, I mean, so the signal is very isotropic in the sky, except that unless, I mean, the galaxy happens to be right behind the pulsar, one of your pulsars. But
What exactly do you mean, as in?
So then the gravitational wave is basically like a quadrupole you see it everywhere. So what are we looking at there?
So the point of using the actual galaxy catalogs is to get a handle on what the likeliest sources to host supermassive black hole binaries in the PTA band are, that we can look in the sky and look at real galaxies and do this kind of bottom-up approach instead of the top-down approach, but looking at simulations and then just saying what time to detection is, which we can also do, and which is actually another project that I'm working on with some people.
But let's say I'm just moving a galaxy a little bit. So how much difference does that make? So the galaxies on average are not as good as homogeneously distributed there everywhere. So
yeah, and so this is important for, there's this transition zone between single sources, anisotropic backgrounds, and isotropic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So this method is only, this is specifically to go after continuous sources, which is why we're using things that are relatively nearby, because you're right that after you go further than, redshift of 0.5, mm-hmm. that for these kinds of searches, it won't really matter, because then everything will be homogeneous and isotropic
okay.
in terms of gravitational waves.
Sorry. I think my point is I'm talking. Yeah, okay.
Right, so absolutely, there is a limit to the usefulness of this kind of survey, but this is specifically for continuous sources.
How well known is the spectrum of supermassive black holes in these smaller galaxies within 200 megaparsecs? What masses of black holes that you'd expect if you were just hitting in these mergers to begin with? I mean, is that a very well-known quantity?
Yeah, you get that from this MM bulge or also M sigma.
Oh, so you're using the MM bulge.
Yeah. Unless you have a dynamically measured mass, in which case you use that.
One thing before we say thanks to Justin for advertising tomorrow, there's another PTA talk, same place, same time. Let's go, Robson. And Gary's here tomorrow afternoon. Room to the office 472.
Yep.
Let's thank her again.